Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Well, I was staying in a hotel recently, and by the way, it was not, you know, a seedy hotel, but they were running this weekend, which I did not participate in, called the Seven Deadly Sins Weekend. And you can imagine what they had on offer for envy, vainglory, sloth, greed, anger, gluttony, and of course, lust. Just goes to show kind of the secular understanding of the seven deadly sins, at least till recently anyway. There might be a bit of a resurgence, but you know, until now, there's been a certain cartoonish aspect to them. They've kind of been seen as, oh, those horrible rules that have kept straight-laced religious folks in line, largely through fear. Well, philosopher Rebecca Kneindike de Young says it's time to revisit those so-called deadly sins and understand why. Why have they been understood for centuries as being deadly? And what can they actually lead us towards? She suggests they can lead us towards living much better lives. She's the author of Glittering Vices and is with us now for the beginning of a new series on this very topic. Rebecca, welcome to Open House.
Thank you very much for having me.
We were talking during the week about this whole notion of the seven deadly sins and how they've kind of started coming back into vogue, at least thinking about them anyway.
Yes, and the interesting thing for me is that I discovered them through a philosophical mode of study, but there was plenty of that floating around in popular culture. There was a series on MTV where they interviewed various rock stars and entertainment figures mm-hmm. on what they thought the seven deadly sins are, and it was an enormous hit and is still a very entertaining segment if you can get a hold of it.
Yeah, I'll have to look at it on YouTube. I'll be interested to know how many of them get it right.
Right.
How many of them get all seven?
But there's lots of misunderstanding out there, and MTV was just one grand showcase of how that can go.
Yeah, you joke in the book about how you've been reading a lot of the 13th century theologian Thomas Aquinas, and as you kept on reading, you discovered all sorts of vices you never knew you had.
That's right. It's a daunting project. And, you know, my students say the same thing when they read the book. They get to the next chapter and they think, okay, maybe this is a vice I won't have to feel guilty about. And then at the end of the chapter, it's like, oh, well, there's another one.
There
okay, let's try the next chapter.
Yeah.
But I had exactly the same experience writing the book. And for me, it wasn't so much guilt-mongering, oh, here's another thing that's wrong with you, oh, no, you're stuck in this one, too. It was rather, at least for me, ironically enough, I think, a kind of liberating process. It's a bit like having something wrong with you that you know you're struggling with, but you don't have a name for it. You don't have a diagnosis. No one sort of can pinpoint for you what's going wrong and where. And I think a lot of people, for example, will go to a psychologist for these sorts of answers, or they'll go out for coffee with their best friend and tell them a problem and say, what do you think is going on here? What do you think is exactly the problem? What's the name of this? And my experience reading the tradition was to find names for things that made sense of who I was, who I wasn't, who I wanted to be, what I was struggling with. And this was, I think, very empowering, surprisingly so. But when I shared the same sorts of material with my students, they had exactly the same experience. And I thought, I need to write this up. This is working for people. This is giving them answers to things, answers to questions that they don't even necessarily know how to ask, but they're definitely have in their hearts, in their minds, things that they're struggling with.
You mentioned Thomas Aquinas, and a lot of the early saints always thought of Jesus Christ as the great physician and them as his kind of co-medico workers in many ways. So you're right, you know, once you've got a diagnosis, you can work towards healing the ill. Let's start with a basic definition then of both vice and also virtue.
It's very easy. I mean, simply these are bad moral habits and good moral habits. And by habit, I don't mean something mechanical or automatic. I mean a practice, a disposition in your life that comes to be formed by action that's repeated over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. So vice is not just simply sin. It's actually ingrained habit.
It is ingrained habit, and it becomes sort of part of who you are. So one of the exercises I ask my students to do at the very beginning of class is to write their own eulogy. What's the speech someone would give to you about you at your funeral? And I tell them, you know, try not to say all the nice things people would say that aren't true. Try to give the speech that would actually say something about who you were. And what you find in a speech like that is that people pinpoint characteristics that are who you are, central to your character, to the kind of person that you were, the kind of life that you lived. They'll say things like, he was a faithful husband, or she was a generous and kind person who worked in the community. And they'll try to identify moral character traits that were either good ones or bad ones. You know, the bad ones usually are the butt of jokes at funeral speeches because people are trying to be nice about them. But in general, vices and virtues are those sort of deeply ingrained character traits, whether good or bad. Bad in the case of vice and good in the case of virtue.
Okay, so envy, vainglory, sloth, greed, anger, gluttony, lust. Interestingly enough, pride isn't there. It was once thought that pride was kind of the root of all of them. Would you still say that?
Absolutely. In fact, that's why I don't have a separate chapter on pride. The reason these vices become habitual and become part of us and become ruts in our character is because there are attempts to make a life for ourselves that finds happiness in something other than God, which is the classic definition of pride, is trying to sort of do God's job for him as if you were good enough to pull it off. And so all of the vices are a particular manifestation of pride, pride showing up in one area or another area.
Yes, and the other thing we need to clarify right from the start too is also that the vices and the virtues don't necessarily correlate, you know, so there's, you know, envy is matched by contentment or vanity by humility or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that was an interesting feature of the history when I looked back. You know, people like to call them the seven deadly sins, and in fact, they're better called vices than sins. They're better called capital than deadly, and there aren't necessarily seven of them. You know, sometimes there were eight, sometimes there were nine. And so all of these things sort of fluctuated. But yeah, there's absolutely no correlation at all between the list, the canonical list of seven virtues, the three theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity, the four cardinal virtues of practical wisdom and justice and courage and temperance. They just don't match up at all with the list of seven vices.
Open House is what you're listening to. Rebecca Kneindike de Young, author of Glittering Vices, is with us. We're talking about the seven deadly sins, or seven deadly vices, if you want to put them. That's seven capital vices, actually, as Rebecca was just mentioning there, the beginning of a seven-week series on this. We're going to talk about envy now. We normally think of envy as saying just being jealous about something or wanting to covet, wanting to have what somebody else has and you don't have. It's actually beyond that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the way I'm using it here doesn't sort of take away from all the ordinary uses of the term, which are perfectly valid. It just pinpoints that in the tradition what we're after is sort of resenting another person as having some good which you don't have because they're having that good and you're lacking it makes you look bad or feel bad about yourself.
So there's actual social role in this.
And I think it really pinpoints the idea that the envious person feels both inferior and vulnerable because they lack what someone else has.
So envy is not just wanting what somebody else has. It's actually wanting the social position they have because they have it.
Right. And you see this in characteristic envious behavior. They don't want to have one too, whatever the particular quality is. They want to take it away from the other person. And so they have it and the other person lacks it. So it really indicates the fact that what they want is the kind of ranked social ranking, the social position, the worth that comes with having that quality and having it exclusively.
Yes.
As in my having it and depriving you of it. And that's why envy turns so malicious, I think. It really involves an attack on the other person and a taking away of their good.
Let's give some practical examples of this. Anybody who is an author knows that when they look at the top 100 books and they look at the first position holder and they see that they are not on the top 100 at all, there could be a little bit of envy there.
Oh, absolutely. There's two different possible reactions to seeing that someone else has achieved something you haven't. One is to say, oh, I'd really like to do that too. Maybe I'll work a little bit harder and try to write a bestseller myself. And that would be a positive response to the disparity between the two of you. But the envious person says, no, if anything, I'll damage their reputation with a few scathing book reviews. And that way, even if I can't have top rank on the list, I can at least knock them off.
Actually, we've had a story in the news just recently, I think, of that happening. The husband of an author who was then going and writing some disparaging remarks on Amazon about some of the competitors' books. That's what envy can actually lead one to do.
Absolutely. Like it's an ugly vice.
It becomes malicious.
Right. And Joseph Epstein, in his lovely little book on envy, says, you know, of all the sins, envy is the one that isn't any fun. It starts miserable, it engages you in malicious, miserable behavior, and then it leaves you miserable in the end. Because, of course, attacking the other person doesn't solve the problem of your lacking worth. It just takes the other person's worth away.
So it's a game you'll never win.
Exactly. In fact, interestingly, all the vices have that kind of dynamic to them. You're after something that the more you pursue it, the more empty it leaves you.
There you go. And then we have this kind of notion that, oh, you know, these are restricting. No, they're called deadly for a reason. They actually do sap us of life.
I really do believe this. And the more I studied them, the more I realized that, in fact, a vice like envy is really robbing us of an opportunity to love and be loved. And the envious person, I think, begins with a lack of self-love. She lacks a sense of her own worth and value that's unconditional and grounded and stable and not threatened by other people's successes. So if you have this confidence and this sense of your own worth, you don't need to lash out in envy in order to try to achieve worth at the expense of others. Mm. And so loving yourself well enables you to engage in true friendships and relationships of love. And envy poisons your view of yourself and thereby destroys your ability to love others as well. And so it's as tragic as it is guilt-inducing. If you realize you have envy, I think the most important thing to realize is that you haven't loved yourself well, and you're going to cut yourself off from the thing that makes life fulfilling, which is being able to love and be loved by others.
This is where the Christian gospel message really comes into its own for me, because you kind of go, well, even how do I love myself without, you know, falling into one of the other sins, without falling into pride, you know, the root of all the other sins. And if you really cotton onto this fact that there is a God of love who loves you enough to enter this world in the person of Jesus and die for you, die so that you wouldn't take necessary punishment for what you've done wrong, as well as die so that you would be overcome from the power that actually holds you enslaved to these kinds of things, and that you're loved that much. If you don't kind of cotton onto that, I don't know if there's another strong enough base to actually build self-love on.
Well, that's an interesting question. There's lots of literature, at least in philosophy, that suggests that the best you can do about envy is to try to turn your envy into motivation to be better. And that's a kind of a sad response, in my view. Also, I think, an inadequate one. I do believe that when you have a love for yourself that's grounded in God's love for you, it's essentially non-comparative, non-competitive, unconditional. And I think you'd be crazy to try to understand the human condition without being well attuned to that fact about us, that we need that kind of love.
Mm. So you as a philosopher, if we wrap it up by saying, okay, I feel envy towards someone. Okay, I feel envy towards somebody at work who got that promotion. You as a philosopher and somebody who comes from a Christian background, your guidance from this point on for that person?
With each of the vices, it's important to realize that there is no sort of quick and behavioral fix. There is no easy remedy, you know, three steps to a better you. What you really need is a change of vision. You need to learn how to see yourself differently and how to see others and the world differently. And for the envious person, what they need is a non-competitive, non-comparative view of themselves. And so one way to do that is to engage in non-competitive activities where my achievement of a good doesn't take away from yours. For example, listening to good music together, taking a hike with another person. There isn't a competition there. There isn't a winner and a loser. One person doesn't enjoy the hike more at the expense of the other person's enjoying it less. There is no sort of way to take away from the other's good. That and cultivating gratitude, sort of thinking at the end of each day, what has gone well for me? What have I blessed with? What am I grateful for? Those things can do, I think, beginner steps at least to opening up a change of vision, which is really the heart of what is required to cure envy.
And here's the fascinating thing is that we're kind of positioning love as the cure for envy rather than contentment, which is what most people would have thought.
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily love at the expense of contentment. It's really a contentment with who you are and the fact that you are loved enough so that you don't have to try to take things away from other people to increase your sense of being adequately loved yourself. And I think that is maybe a good description of what contentment ultimately is.
Mm. All right. Well, we'll get into some vainglory this time next week, and I won't be looking in the mirror all week between now and when we speak then. Thanks, Rebecca.
All right. Thank you very much.
Dr. Rebecca Kneindijk-DeYoung, author of Glittering Vices, A New Look at the Seven Deadly Sins and Their Remedies. Yep, vainglory next. And of course, the whole series will be on openhouseonline.com.au for podcast.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.